Hi.
Hi, Ty. We are good to go.
Cool.
So let's start with your year of graduation, including if you finished up your coursework, spring, summer, fall, and your major or majors.
I think it was fall 22.
As in, you finished your last class in December.
Oh, is that what it? Okay.
I'm just saying, people say fall. That's like, that's when you're last semester.
So I was, I'm trying, like, the way that Berkeley says it, it was, I think it was, like, interdisciplinary arts with my concentration in music business and marketing.
Were you a professional music? Bachelor of Music degree, right?
Yeah, bachelor. No, it's a Bachelor of Arts.
Oh, you were in the BA program.
Yeah.
It's a very small program. Oh, you right, brick and mortar Berkeley or Berkeley Online?
I did a year in brick and mortar, and I finished online.
Understood. Okay. Yep.
I got degree completion online.
Gotcha. Okay. Yeah. The Berkeley Online degree is slightly different, but I've interviewed other Berkeley Online folks. Very cool. All right. So we will get to your history later, but for now, tell us about your current job. Where do you work? What do you do?
So I work in, I'm a retention marketing manager. For a gaming company. So that mostly revolves around, I'm responsible for two markets within our larger operations, and I'm responsible for the monetization and activation and retention of the existing user base.
Mm-hmm.
And, for those markets. So that's the strategic side of it, and also the operational side in terms of overseeing all components of marketing campaigns that target our users.
Great. And you said for a gaming company, do you mind sharing what company you work for?
The Lauder.
Okay. What type of games? Is this, desktop computer games, app games?
No, like lottery, scratch cards, casino, that type of,
Got it. So stuff where you actually are, like, putting up money.
Yeah.
Can win money. Okay. Understood. That's a thing in all 50 states, or there's states where you...
No, it's actually very, very complicated. That's the reason why we have me kind of very focused on the U.S., because this is a global company, and the global side of the operations is actually a lot more straightforward. In most places, an entire country either just it's allowed or it isn't. In the U.S., it's heavily political. It kind of changes per state. It can change very quickly with the, first of all, the regulations are per state, which means that you need different licenses, different agreements, whatever, per state, and they can come and go very easily depending on all sorts of things, like which party takes control of the state senate that particular year.
I see. Hey, do you know off the top of your head, since I'm here in Massachusetts, is this playable in Massachusetts?
I think largely not. I mean, we're not in Massachusetts.
Okay.
Massachusetts, I believe, has recently passed legislation that could make this a bigger thing within the next, let's say, few years. But not as of the moment.
Got it. So... about how many employees are at Lauder?
I would say maybe like 150.
Okay. Decent size. Are you all in one office? You spread all over the world?
No, we have various branches, Tel Aviv, Romania, Malta, the U.S. It's kind of a spread out.
Interesting. And where are you again?
I'm in Washington, D.C.
Gotcha. How many other people are there?
None in D.C. I'm actually kind of a remote nomad for us, but in New Jersey we have a growing branch.
Sure, sure. So you talked about retention marketing. So as you said, that was to the people who are currently using Lotter, right? Encouraging them to keep using it, I assume?
Yeah. So it's both. It's primarily kind of the main focuses is people who've just signed up, funneling them into the actual, you know, part where they've become active users. And in terms of people who are active, it's about keeping them.
Cool. Could you give an example? I mean, not going for any trade secrets here, but what's a type of promotion that you would have taken the lead on? Like what sort, you know, just a little more specific, like an example of the type of thing you do.
Sure. So there's nothing too unique. We're doing mostly what any other company would do, which is that we target, let's say, more aggressive promotions to people who have either yet to first play or who haven't played in a significant amount of time. And that's the typical thing where if you go to any website and you hang out, you'll probably get a pop-up within a few minutes, moments, whatever, that offers you some discount if you make your first purchase or if you sign up for a mailing list, etc. So that's one of the typical things, is just giving someone a good deal on their first order in order to get them through the door. In terms of the active player base, actually this month is a great example, because basically the biggest shopping event of the year is, I think for almost all companies, is that week of Thanksgiving, Black Friday, Cyber Monday. Users already have an expectation to receive something for that. So that's a great time to reward loyal users with, you know, big site-wide offers, big discount offers, cash back, whatever you kind of calculate is in the best interest of both sides.
Sure.
And then the, you know, a promotion isn't just what the user is receiving, it's also the way you communicate that to them. It's what channels, it's how you're going to let them know, who you're going to try and let know, because obviously you have to put in your efforts into particular sections of the user base. You can't always be in contact with everyone. So that's kind of the overview of it. And as of a specific thing might be what we, you know, are working on now, which is, let's say, a Black Friday sale. So what are the various ways you're going to communicate that? What you're going to give, it changes per market. Different states, different countries, et cetera, will have different profit margins. So 10% here might not be the same for the company as 10% someplace else. It might be significantly more or less expensive for us to give that number, depending on the margins that we're operating on. So all that's being taken into account.
Sure.
Yeah.
All right, I got it. And as you said, it's a remote position. About how many hours a week do you work?
I think it's supposed to be in the high 40s. It tends to go over because, you know, that's just the tendency.
Right. There's a project that has to get done.
Yeah. I think with this kind of work, it's like it's always, everything's working on deadlines. Deadlines tend to run late just by virtue of, you know, existing. But it tends to be, let's say an ideal week is your typical, we're not 9 to 5, we're 9 to 6, like 5 days a week, but it tends to, you know, to run over when there's a need.
understood. And let's see. Do you mind like taking us through what a typical work day looks like for you? Kind of hour by hour?
Sure. Even though it's quite dynamic, but typically I'd say that my stuff breaks down into there's a lot of meetings. It's not atypical, but we have a big meetings culture. Meetings are great in terms of actually getting to, you know, sync with everyone, make sure everyone's aligned, but they do dig in significantly to work time. So I expect to put a certain amount of time into just communication, right? So that's meetings, that's backlogs of emails, that's messages that come up through the day. A certain other chunk of time would go into more, let's say, yes, analysis, reporting. That's kind of stuff that I would do on my own, building various reports, checking on the, I tend to start my day, if nothing else interrupts it, with just checking the numbers, seeing what we made per market, per product the previous day, seeing how any campaigns that went out did. All that work becomes significantly more significant at the beginning of the next month, because that's when we do a lot of summaries. But on a typical day, it's just kind of checking the most recent numbers. And then in terms of, I think, like the biggest chunks of time in a given day just go towards the actual grunt work of a campaign, a large component of which is coordinating between teams. We'll have content working on the content side. We have design. We have compliance. So, you know, many people will be involved. Many stakeholders will have opinions. So if you're lucky, you ask for all the parts and you get them and you put it together and everyone's happy. And realistically speaking, or more realistically speaking, there's significant revisions that can go on quite a long time. And the longer that revisions go on, the more you are working towards a deadline. And then the other side of campaigns, you know, on a daily basis is the operational side, actually configuring them, scheduling them, making sure that everything's going out correctly, QAing everything to make sure that there's no issues, no little mistakes. So I think that's largely a day, let's say.
How many, I'm sure it varies, but I'm just trying to get my hands on a general idea. And how many campaigns do you do in a given week?
So probably I aim to have one or two unique new, what we call ad hoc campaigns, on a weekly basis per market. So that might, depending on various needs, that might be one thing that I can send everyone, or it might be a bunch of different things that I can only send to that specific place, which will change the amount of workload. But that's kind of what we'll work on to send for that week. We're always working on our automated plan, which is our, you know, a huge bank, basically, of recurring campaigns that sit and they run daily and they target a very specific segment of the user base or whatever. So we're always working on expanding that, improving that, running A/B tests on that. So while the same time that we're working on these new campaigns, we also have all these other campaigns running, slowly adding to them, slowly changing them, slowly optimizing them. And then while we have those like one or two weekly campaigns, we usually will have like one or two bigger events in a given month that we're working towards as we're doing those, as we're kind of like breezing through the smaller campaigns. So if this month I, or if this week I have some I had like a small campaign, let's say it was on Monday. Most of my effort was still targeted towards Thanksgiving, Black Friday, Cyber Monday, because that's where the real time and energy is being put into.
All right, got it. And in order to qualify for these interviews, what if the criteria you have to hit is that you enjoy what you do? So what is it about this, your retention marketing, that you enjoy?
So for me, it's mostly the, I think there's a lot to find interesting in the operational side of what we do and how it works in terms of, you know, the specific thing of what the business is, what it sells, whatever, you know, I can say that that's not what my background is. That's not something, it's not like I targeted this particular industry. And for me, it's mostly the actual work, which I think is, would be similar in any industry. And that's advertising is this weird thing because on the one hand, it's this very corporate capitalist thing. But it's always been very tied with creativity. And you can even look, you know, the history of advertising in the 50s and the 60s and all these iconic promotions that we hang in museums today, like their art, but they were promos in a magazine to sell cigarettes, right?
Right.
And I find that just a fascinating, weird thing that what we do is, it's not artistically motivated, and yet we're designers and writers, and we sit and we talk about changing a shade of pink, you know, making it 2% lighter in order to better bring out the contrast of something. Like, there is something inherently creative in what's driving everyone on the team. People are working to make, you know, you give someone 6 words maximum for a subject line, and they spend time really trying to think what the best possible combination of words could be. And I've always really liked working within strict limitations. You know, when I did music, I liked working on, like, I liked jazz combos and stuff where there was a very limited amount of instruments. And I think that's similar to what we do. We work within very limited spaces, right? We work within something like an email where the most important part of an email isn't what's in the email itself, it's the subject line. Because
sure.
The biggest point where you lose or gain people is in opening it, and most people who open it, that's kind of most of the battle. Now, subject lines, there's studies on this all the time, right? Like, everyone is out there trying to find what makes for a good subject line. We're running A-B tests on this all the time. Just kind of digging into the weird minutiae of what makes someone slightly more likely to open an email is, I think, just one of those weird, interesting things that I find fascinating to put effort into. And, you know, it's also just, I was never the most prolific at, in terms of, you know, when I was doing music, whatever, I feel like it's a struggle to kind of get what I wanted done. Like, I always had a lot of ideas, but it's hard to put effort into those kinds of things, especially when it's not like something you're making money out of. I think being forced to just produce on a daily basis mm-hmm. is also an interesting thing, especially from people who come from a background like I do, where you feel pretty satisfied if you write a song in a few months or whatever. So just kind of being able to go on our site on a daily basis, see all the various things that I've had a hand in, be up there, be, you know, seeing stuff out, you know, like, I don't know, something I wrote was on an ad in the radio. And it's just an interesting thing to constantly kind of have this like level of production that's out there and that is being seen and being heard. And it's, you know, it's not as exciting as when I was doing, maybe, you know, it's not as maybe artistically fulfilling as when I was doing things like writing musicals or whatever, but it's also out there in public and
sure.
kind of a sign of the fact that, you know, I'm working on something and it's a value and it exists out in the world on a regular basis.
Very cool. All right. Let's take it back now to 2022, although if you feel this story has a logical earlier starting point, we can take it back before that. But, you know, otherwise, as things are wrapping up with Berkeley Online, I mean, I'm guessing you're not thinking marketing manager, the place that does your online gambling.
I was already by that point, because I did my degree completion while being a full-time student. I was a full-time student while I was a full-time employee.
Okay, cool. Well, all right. So then let's say I'm kind of just going for your story as to how did you end up where you're doing what you're doing now. And maybe we could even start from the point when you were at Brick and Mortar Berkeley. And
then what your path. So I went to Berkeley straight out of high school for I did a year doing trumpet performance.
And when was that?
This was this would have been like 2013.
Okay.
I was bad at school. Like I guess I should rephrase that. I was at a very competitive place academically, and because of that, I always felt like I was very bad at school, because I was at a place that kind of the target in terms of middle school, high school, the target was always very clearly Ivy League, academically, and because that's not where I was at academically, the target for us was, I always felt, was that we needed to be really, really, really good at something and we needed to pursue that to the ends of the earth. And so because I played trumpet and I was better at trumpet than the people around me, which I think is a typical experience because I think trumpet is at a low, like it's not a thing that a lot of people are good at in high school. I think there tends to be a good trumpet player in a grade pretty universally. It's not something like saxophone or piano where there, or violin where it's as competitive. Because of that, I thought it was obvious that I wouldn't go into something academic. I would go into music. Once I got into Berkeley, I think the issue is when you take all the people who were the best trumpet player in their grade and put them in a room, suddenly everyone's a good trumpet player. And at that point, I realized that there's just, I think, a level of passion for the idea of being a professional trumpet player that other people had that I didn't have. So I left Berkeley to try and understand better about what I wanted to do. And I, at some point, moved to Israel, which is where my family's from.
Okay.
When I was there, I was trying to, you know, find a way to, you know, become more, like fit in more, find connections. There I attended Limon, which is a Berkeley sister school in Israel.
Okay, so you're still studying music.
Yeah, I still studied. I wanted to do music. Like, I've always been doing music. I still wanted to do music, but I knew I didn't want to do performance specifically. Okay. So I went to Amman and I studied music production for 2 years. And that time I was freelancing mostly with music. Like, I was teaching privately. I was mixing and mastering freelance. I really liked the technical side of it. And also, like, learning the technical side of it is something I really enjoyed. And when COVID hit, that hurt my freelancing a bit. And I wanted something more stable. And I was looking at the options that were available to me there. And because I was an English speaker in a non-English speaking country, I saw that as being, that was like my main advantage. And so I went into the company that I currently work at as a content writer.
Let's see, how did you end up getting this job? Apply or did someone?
I applied. I applied around, and at the time, the job market was stronger than it is now. Now I would assume things would be more challenging. But
you were in Israel still at this time.
Yeah, I was in Israel still, I was in Tel Aviv specifically. And Tel Aviv is a bit of a tech hub, so there's a big demand for content writers, and specifically for English speakers with some technical experience. And I think that, you know, I was looking around also at things related to, I was, you know, interviewing at the time also with some things more related to the music industry, but because I got offered something that, you know, interested me, and I for me, it was kind of like a first, like an entry level step into, you know, the corporate, office-y world. I took it. And then when I was there, I was originally in a position that was more entry level, more like much less time consuming and strenuous than the one I have now. And because I knew that I kind of had gotten a bit of a foot into the door, but wasn't yet where I wanted to be, I thought that would be a good time to complete my degree.
Sure. And more that's what Berkeley Online's there for. Right.
Yeah. And kind of look more at the marketing business side of it, because, you know, I still obviously like to work in music at some point would always, like, you know, not as a musician, but within the scope of it, would always be of interest at some point. But just I because I'd gotten involved in a marketing department and wanted to see what, you know, what various skills or various next steps I could take within that. That's what my what I decided to focus on when I did my degree completion.
Got it. You start Berkeley Online in 2021, and a couple of years later, and you're working full time. Were you doing like two classes a semester?
No, I think I was doing four. I think I was doing the normal.
Doing four while working full time, that's a lot. I teach at Berkeley Online, so.
I think again at the time it was. I don't think I would be able to do that with my current position and work. You know, I know I couldn't do that with my current workload. At the time, it was a different position. It was easier, but I do think that I was pretty driven to do that. It's something, you know. I always thought of myself as lazy when I was just in school, because I don't have a great, let's say, ethic for schoolwork. But I think once I actually started working in an organized way, I found that I can work for very long periods of time without burning out. I think it just, as long what I realized once I was actually within the workforce is that as long as I can understand why I'm doing something and the value of it and the results of it, I'm very highly motivated. I think originally when I was in school, I struggled to see those connections, and I struggled to motivate myself to put in the amount of work. Once I was in Berkeley Online, I didn't have that issue because I already understood what I wanted. I understood what I was interested in. I understood the connections between coursework and work and how I could take those ideas and concepts and run with them. And at that point, it felt like, sure, I can do both if that means that I, you know, progress, right?
Got it. So as you said, you finish up in late 2022. When did you get your promotion?
I spent a year in content, and then I moved over to retention because I was looking for something. So this would be probably like 2023. I was looking for something more, I guess, central to our business. I wanted to grow within the marketing department, and I think, you know, because I'd worked with that team, I already knew that there was a lot of interesting things going on there. So when something opened up in the team, I applied for it internally and got it. And then I want to say a few months into that, got moved up from being on the, from like the retention manager position to a position that is responsible for overseeing the markets that I currently oversee.
Yeah, it is. That's really great. Oh, by the way, are you anyone's direct supervisor?
No, not currently.
Yeah, that's fine. There are a lot of positions with a lot of responsibility that don't involve direct supervision. Just wanted to double check.
Yeah, we have a complicated structure currently, but
All right, very cool. So, oh, and when did you end up moving then back to the United States?
I moved November, I guess exactly a year ago, basically. Yeah.
Do you mind if I ask what inspired you to move back? Because you were at this company, you were living in Israel, everything seems to be fine. So what prompted you?
There was a war. But, well, I can say that, you know, I was born there. That's where my family's from. But I grew up here, so I obviously it's more comfortable for me and more natural for me here. I speak the language better. Not that, you know, I'm fluent in Hebrew, but it's a bit more challenging. And culturally, it's a very different from what I grew up with.
Sure.
So the plan was always at some point, kind of. That's also, you know, why I wanted to take the opportunity there where I had English as a big advantage to kind of get my foot in the door in some industry and then hopefully convert that into something over here. And then the war just made it, it's a very difficult situation over there for, I think, everyone involved. And it's easier to be here.
Makes complete sense. And just curious, like, were you from the Washington, D.C. area?
Yeah, I grew up and went to school in Maryland. So not in Washington D.C., but close enough.
All right. My wife's from Silver Spring, Maryland. So
yeah, so I was in Bethesda. So
okay. Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. All right. Cool. So just outside D.C., like on the metro. All right. Excellent. So we'll move on to the third part of the interview of three. So let me preface this next question with there's no right or wrong answer. So these days, like the second half of 2024, what, if anything, is your current relationship with music?
I have a keyboard next to my desk. Mm-hmm. A lot of times it's just kind of like a de-stressor, you know, like I'm in the office all day. I work remote so there's always the opportunity to take 5 minutes and just play something. So I would say my current relationship with music is for me. It's, you know, I play for my own enjoyment. I continue to write things mostly for my own enjoyment. And I think there's always the urge of like, oh, I could record this, I could do that with it, but you know, there's not that much time, and there was always a stress associated with that when I was doing that. So there's something nice about transitioning to a point where music is a fun hobby. I hated performing, meaning, I thought I wanted to do it because it's what you're told you should do if you're good at music, but it made me so anxious and nervous every single time. So every once in a while I have like the slight desire to maybe go and do something and then remember that it wasn't the most positive. But yeah, that's most of it. I mostly just kind of write for myself, play for myself.
That's actually As you can imagine, I ask everyone that question and stuff them into one of a few categories. And, you know, it's quite common. About one person in five said something pretty much exactly what you just said. And then another one person in four, like, isn't doing music at all.
Yeah, I would find it hard to imagine. You know, I say that even though I like trumpet was my main thing for so long. And I haven't touched a trumpet in a while. I didn't take mine when I moved at very short notice with very few things. So I didn't take it, and it's been a year and I haven't super missed it. But yeah, in terms of like not being able to be near a piano, at least I think that would be difficult. Like it's a nice, calming, fun, creative thing to be able to do.
Gotcha. Very cool. Okay, so next question is, you ended up, well, sort of getting into your company before your degree was completed, then you completed it and, you know, got promoted pretty soon after. People, I'm sure, go into positions like yours with many different educational backgrounds. So let's say, compared to if you just got somewhere else, you know, studied history or something, is there anything you feel your Berklee experience did particularly well to prepare you for your current job?
I mean, I wouldn't say that, like, it was important for me to finish my degree, because I think having the degree, it definitely does, you know, it's definitely a worthwhile thing. It also opens up more opportunities in the future if I choose to, you know, pursue a, let's say, a master's in what I'm doing now or something. But I think for me, more important to the actual experience is a few things. I can obviously say that being able to immerse for like a year or two in coursework related to what I do, and actually having the benefit of already working while doing it, so having a really clear idea of what is the most relevant to how the industry currently works, what is less relevant, various things. It's obviously helpful, I think. Because I'm new to what I do and I'm early on in that journey, let's say, every opportunity to develop and learn something is really massive. Like, I feel like my growth within the first 3 years at this company is going to be much more, you know, it's exponentially a lot more than I would expect, let's say, for the next 3 years. But also just, I think even going back to when I was 18 and taking music tech on campus and all that stuff, I think there's a large component of what is cool about Berklee, specifically in comparison to if I'd, not to say that there aren't, you know, production programs at every school, but in terms of the focus and Berklee's kind of contemporary focus and the idea that everyone, every musician should know their way around a DAW and all that stuff, is I think that there's this idea that my generation and younger generations are inherently technical. And I think that's often not true, because we grew up with very easy devices, whereas people like in my parents' generation grew up with very complicated and hard to understand devices. So the people then who mastered them are, you know, like my grandfather mastering computers in the 70s, that's huge. Like, he spent the rest of his life knowing how to make anything work. I look at someone like my nephew, who struggles with an iPad if it's not doing the same, like the five basic functions you need to play a video, and think that there is something that gets very very lost in how easy devices are nowadays, considering that once you enter the workforce, I think a lot of jobs are so technical now, even if people don't really acknowledge it or understand it from the outside. You're constantly dealing with software that changes all the time. Like, it's not like you in the 90s where there was like the Office suite and it kind of stayed the same for 20 years. Like, our project management suite changes the way we interact with them. Like, this year everything is AI functions, the year before that, you know, it's kind of like there's constantly stuff to learn. I think one of the biggest things from Berkeley is just music software is so difficult. Like, it's very complicated, it's very challenging. Just getting VSTs from all sorts of different years and generations to work with all sorts of different software, like piping audio from all these various different sources. I think even if you don't touch a DAW again for the rest of your life, it is really helpful in getting a mindset of understanding the kind of the intersection between modern creativity and just these convoluted technical workflows that we all have to live with because of the current state of technology. And I think that's something that's been continuously helpful. It's a huge boost in terms of it competitively to be the person in the room who can make any software do the thing that other people haven't yet considered that it might be capable of doing, which is, I think, very unique to a skill you learn in music creation, probably in the same thing with art creation. But because when you open up, let's say, a Logic session, it's a blank canvas, and then you have ideas, and then you try and make the software, like force the software to make those ideas happen. You develop this style of thinking where you think about what you want, and then you create the thing that makes it happen. Something that I see all the time in my work and at friends' workplaces is that people don't even try because they don't know that the software can do the thing and they don't have the instinct of maybe I could make it do that thing.
Got it. That's really interesting response. Thank you.
Sure.
Let's flip that question around now. Because obviously Berkeley's a music college. You went Berkeley and then Berkeley Online later, knowing that. And you're doing very well for yourself in a career sense. But all that said, when you look back at your Berkeley education, is there anything where you say, you know, hey, it would have been really useful to have learned this while I was at Berkeley, and they could have taught it to me, and they didn't? Anything missing or incomplete in your education?
I think that's kind of difficult because, you know, I can always say that because I didn't go, as you know, so far into the thing that I was studying, that it's, you know, harder for me to say, you know, it's not like I think that necessarily that it needs to be more catered to what I currently do, because what I currently do isn't exactly what I was studying. But
I mean, if you don't think it's fair, I will say, you know, a little under 1 person in 10 said, like, nah, they taught me what they meant to taught me, and, like, I took it from there. 9 people in 10 do have something that they wish they'd learned more, but I don't want to put words in your mouth.
Sure. I think when I look back on my education in general, I think it's maybe, you know, I would say it's less specifically related to my day to day. I think that something in general that I, looking back, wish was a larger, you know, an element of my education, almost just in a kind of holistic, you know, developing as an adult kind of way, is that I think that a lot of our education has a kind of an is-ought problem to it, in which, you know, we studied songs that are known, or we studied, you know, music that is known to be good, and then we came up with all sorts of theoretical reasons as to why it's good. We kind of start with the assumption that everyone agrees that something is good, and then, okay, so like, let's analyze the chord progression of this and come to an agreement on, I guess this is a good chord progression. I think when I look back, what I wish for is more of an approach of, I guess, being more critical and inquisitive about why we think that the things that we think are good.
Interesting.
Taking things that we think are good and things that we think are bad and comparing them. Something that we didn't really do, to my, in my personal experience, is analyze the chord progression of a song that we think is bad and then come up with the reasons why we think it's bad. And I say that not because I think it's some very specific skill that would make my day-to-day easier, but I do think I face this on my day-to-day at work, which is that we work off of assumptions a lot. I don't think this is specific to any particular company or team or whatever. I think this is kind of something that we all tend to fall into, which is we assume that something is correct, and then we kind of venture forth from that assumption, and we will base a campaign around something that we think makes sense. A lot of times when I'm looking at A/B testing, I'm realizing that not all of our assumptions pan out, and that's actually the most interesting. Like, it's the most interesting to get a result that feels completely the opposite of what any reasonable common sense person would think. And I think I relate that to the idea of, you know, we assume Mozart is a genius, we say he's great, we analyze a piece, and then we try and draw conclusions from that, as opposed to maybe like a more interesting, almost kind of data-focused approach, where we take, like, let's say the top 10 most popular songs, the top 10 least popular songs of a year, let's say within a scope of like the top 1,000 songs, analyze them and see trends, right? Like, that's a lot of how we think in a modern sense, right? Like, in terms of at work, we look for trends, we look for data-driven or data-justified action items or points that we can take away. And I think that would have been an interesting thing to explore instead of maybe just kind of focusing on this kind of common sense approach of, these are the things that are good, these are the things that are important, and not really thinking deeper than that as to why that's the subject matter, like why these are the things that have been picked to focus on for this theory class.
Very interesting. Thank you. So next question I have for you is, you actually got into your career before you even completed your degree, which is, you're not the first person I've spoken with, but it's rare.
Yeah.
And a lot of people who might graduate and they haven't really found their footing yet, or current students who are kind of staring out into the big scary world, especially ones who maybe went straight in after high school and they're wondering what comes next. So for either or both of those groups, what advice do you have?
I think the thing that constantly surprises me every day is how many jobs there are that you don't know about until you meet someone who does that job. I think when you're in high school, people are constantly talking to you about paths and what you're going to do. And because in high school, everything is still hopes and dreams, I think we tend to focus on these kinds of things that everyone knows about. What I've found, I think, amongst myself, the people that I work with, and friends group, is that there's a lot of places in which you can kind of get your foot in the door first, even if it's not a position, let's say, that you think you would love to do or is super related to your experience, but it's a position at a place And you can then, once you're in that place, look at what everyone else is doing, look at all the teams, especially in tech companies where there's just a lot of different little branches of people doing completely different things. And there's, I think, many people, you know, within, especially I think in my generation where we tend to jump around a lot and we don't do a thing for 30 years and just kind of vertically advance in a clear way, where you find some little niche that you weren't previously aware of, but that makes it easier to, I guess, develop, find competitive advantages for yourself and advance within that community. I'm doing something that I didn't know existed until 3 years ago. So I think, and when I say I didn't know existed, I mean, obviously I knew that marketing existed, but all these, it's that even within something that you might know, there's just an infinite amount of these subsections, right? I think all my life when I would have thought about marketing, I mostly was imagining advertising that's targeting, you know, like the acquisition side. You know, you, most of your day, you're experiencing commercials and ads and billboards and posters and all sorts of stuff that's targeting like acquisition. And I hadn't thought until 3 years ago about the fact that every company that exists is also putting effort into just reminding the users who already exist that, hey, we're here and maybe you would like to order again. So I think, especially now, since I think there's, we're kind of more becoming generalist focused in the corporate space. It's less that people go and study a very specific thing and then work with in that very specific thing their entire lives. It's kind of like we're flexible. We learn overall abilities and trends and we try and apply them to many, many different things. And it really helps you to have a wide variety of skills. It helps you to be a writer who also can design, and it helps you to be a designer who can also write and all this kind of stuff. I think there's just a lot of opportunities out there that we don't know about until we start kind of looking into the nooks and crannies of any particular company and seeing what all the different positions are. Even just kind of going to a company's, like a company that you like, let's say, going to their jobs page and just scrolling through 100 different job descriptions. And using that as some sort of just like, there's so many different things that you can take a job description and turn that into a path of, I'm going to like spend a few months learning these specific skills, right?
Right. Cool. So to focus in a little bit, you are my, again, something like 254th interview subject, and I think you're my 15th person in marketing. It's not my first, but, you know, a lot less.
Yeah.
And I think anyone who made it this far in the interview, listening to it, that is, you know, maybe considering marketing as a career.
Yeah.
So for someone who's not yet doing it, but is really thinking about marketing as a career, what specific advice do you have for that?
I think it really, and I would say it helps at this point. I think kind of like what I alluded to in the former one, I think the generalist thing is really important. I think having a kind of, let's say, wide and shallow over specific and deep ability pool. So if I think I can say for myself that I think, you know, if we were hiring at this point someone entry level, to me the thing that would be the most nice to see is comfort with a wide range of things. And that's something that you don't need to, you know, you don't need to go to school for. You don't need to spend 2 years studying. You can create a Figma account and get good enough. Like, not an expert, you can get good enough, and you can try, you know, you can open an Airtable account and try and create a project management workflow and get good enough at it, right? There's all these programs that are, again, they're not terrifying. They're not something that no normal person can learn. They are something that takes some learning, right? So coming into an interview with those, like, some level of those skills already under, well, I think it also makes you more confident. But I think especially, like, the past year and the way everyone's trying to kind of make AI work for them in every particular organization, and the amount of change that's coming, a lot of these changes are being pushed, various companies from higher up, right? Like, there's a kind of a pressure to advance the workflow somehow, to modernize, to change it in order to show that we're doing something. And I think just the ability to show that you're flexible, that you can learn new skills, I think that's the biggest thing, because I see this a lot with people who are young, like younger than me, where they've mastered a skill and then something in the workflow changes, right? There is a change to a different software because someone struck a deal or whatever, and they don't make the transition. Like, it just, they've already learned how to do all the steps, and they thought that they were going to be able to do that for the next 10 years, and now someone's coming and saying, we're changing everything, and it takes them a really long time, and they struggle with it like crazy. And I think that's going to be the big skill for now and for the foreseeable future in marketing, is that you don't know what you're going to be doing. You might come in as a content writer and be told in a year, like next year from now on, we want all of our content to be AI generated. So your new job is to oversee that workflow, the pipeline, right? And I think it behooves you to be able to make that transition seamlessly. You might go into something on the acquisition side, and then because a nice opportunity opens up on the affiliate side of marketing, you might want to make that jump because promotions don't come by that often. And at that point, the best skill that you can show is the skill to adapt to kind of transform to any environment.
Sure.
I think that's much more meaningful at this point with the state of marketing as it currently is than experience, because obviously no one who's entry level has experience, so that's always kind of a catch-22, but a kind of an in-depth knowledge of a specific thing, because I think at this point most departments know that there's no guarantee that the workflow and the process and all the stuff that they have today is the same as what they'll have in a year from now.
Gotcha, that makes a lot of sense. Well, I just have one last question for you, Itay, which is, you have the mic. Is there anything we missed or anything else you'd like to say?
I think that would cover what I would think. I think if there is something that I think about a lot, it's that there's an idea that musicians are inherently, or by virtue of being musicians, are better at a lot of this kind of stuff. They might be people, I think, especially outside of music, tend to work under the assumption that being musical makes you better at math or more analytical or something like that. Mm-hmm. And I do think that that is a myth technically, but maybe has some kind of deeper truth to it. But apart from not necessarily thinking that there is a straight line between the two things, it is something that I heard a lot in interviews, and it's something that I think people pursuing a job outside of music should consider, because I think a lot of people who are trying to make that jump might have some insecurities. Obviously, anyone who's searching for an entry-level position or kind of making a switch or anything like that, there's always a feeling that you're looking at these job descriptions that are asking for something that, you know, you couldn't possibly have, and like all this, all these requirements, and interviews are stressful, and people sometimes are aggressive in them and all that stuff. And I think that might lead people to try and bury the lead on their musical background, maybe try and talk around Berklee as a place they went to, like all sorts of things like that. I think it's important to keep in mind that no matter what any individual person might think, the truth to this idea is, culturally, I do think, like, at least in my experience being interviewed and talking to various people at work, people are impressed by musicians. People are impressed by musical accomplishments. People tend to think that it is a definite sign of intelligence, of capability. I think that's a nice thing to keep in mind in terms of a bit of a boost, also in terms of, I guess, you know, I 100% don't want to give any resume advice ever, because I don't want to be liable for anything. But, you know, just in terms of, in the consideration of how you choose to present things, that Berklee does, even though it's a school of music, have a good reputation. I can say, as someone who lived in a different country, people didn't know Juilliard on the street, but they knew Berklee, specifically because so many famous Israeli musicians went to Berklee. So, you know, mileage may vary depending on your country, but it's just wanted to share in my experience that I think it's a real boost and something that can be a helpful mindset about coming from a musical background, coming from Berklee, if you do choose to make to either begin your career in a different field or transition to a different field.
Okay, no, great point. Well, thank you so much, Itay, for making the time to talk today. I really enjoyed this conversation.
Sure, me too.
All right, well, best of luck with everything.
Great.
Have a great rest of your week.
Bye.